Well, good morning, everybody. You can't read far in the Gospels without coming across Pharisees. I did a bit of counting. 30 references in Matthew and 27 in Luke. And there's only one reference to them in the Sermon on the Mount that we've just come to the end of. That's chapter 5, verse 20. But they're probably also in the Sermon on the Mount in those verses in chapter 6, where Jesus talks about people whom he describes as hypocrites. You remember that he repeatedly describes the Pharisees by name as hypocrites in chapter 23. So why do they figure so prominently? Why is Jesus so harsh towards Pharisees? Who were they? The movement of Pharisees, it's thought, goes back to about 150 BC. It's a time just after the Maccabean War, and it's thought that the Pharisaic movement grew out of scribes and sages in Israel at that time who wanted to call Israel back to God, back to truer, purer faithfulness to their law. They also wanted to defend Jewish customs, Jewish language, Jewish thought, Jewish religion against the growing influence of Greek culture in Israel ever since the time of the invasion by Alexander. That influence had been growing, and so this was a kind of counter movement. But the particular form that it took was that it was an attempt to make all Israelites conform to the level of purity that was actually prescribed only for priests. Someone's written about it. All Jews had to observe the purity laws which applied to the temple service outside the temple. And that was an impossibly hard, high level of purity. Now, I'm sure those intentions were good, but their outcome was probably inevitable over the course of time. As you read the Gospels, it's clear that Jesus did meet some Pharisees whom he esteemed for their genuineness and their aspiration to holiness. But mostly what we see is something much more negative. And so Jesus describes how they prefer to fulfill the easy bits of the law at the expense of the more difficult ones. Remember when he talks about tithing in chapter 20, in 23, at the expense of what he called the weightier matters of the law. They emphasize the visible, measurable parts of the law, like, for example, hand washing that Jesus talks about in chapter 15. And as chapter 6 tells us in those early, first part of chapter 6, they tended to play to the gallery, to seek to impress others by their holy actions and to gain respect and honour. And as the beginning of chapter 7 says that we read this morning, they tended to apply double standards, very critical to of others, but much more mild in their judgments of themselves, he says. And that was part of another feature of the Pharisees, that they inevitably, perhaps inevitably, regarded themselves as better than others and looked down upon those whom they called the people of the land. In other words, the ignorant, the great unwashed, who don't know the law and don't keep it. And Jesus suggests in chapter 23 that scribes and Pharisees' teaching had the effect of making it impossible for the ordinary person to keep the law, and effectively dispirited them and drove them away, if anything. He talks about them shutting up the kingdom to other people without going in themselves. And one more thing, he talks in chapter 15 also about a rather more cynical practice, their manipulation of the law for personal advantage. You know, the law of Corban, which meant that they didn't need to provide support for their parents because they could describe that money as being given to God. So it's a pretty unlovely picture that emerges overall. People wanting to gain public esteem, be honoured, be esteemed, be influential, gain social power, sometimes even financial gain, by means of religion, using, in a sense, God for personal advantage. And they were clearly widely respected and honoured in Israel. But there's something that was perhaps in a way even worse. You remember that parable that Jesus tells in Luke 18 about the Pharisee and the tax collector? And the Pharisee, Jesus describes as firstly comparing himself with other people and thanking God that he's not like them, but then saying, listing his own good works, as it were, boasting before God about his good actions and implying that he deserves God's favour for that. He has claims on God because he's been such a dutiful observer of the law. He gives himself a pat on the back for doing it. Now, as I say, it seems that the Pharisees were fairly widely respected, well thought of in Israel. But Jesus' view wasn't like that. It's quite clear that Jesus, as he says in chapter 6, saw them as hypocrites. There's a passage in chapter 15 where he quotes from Isaiah. It's in connection with the question of hand washing. You remember he says, "This people honours me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." And that was particularly said about the Pharisees. Now, you probably know that the Greek word for hypocrites actually means an actor on the stage. And in the classical world, an actor wore a mask. So to say of people that they are hypocrites was effectively to say that they wear a mask, that there's a difference between what you see and the inner reality, between the surface and the depths, between what's inside and what's outside. Now, Jesus was not deceived by this surface of the Pharisees. There's an interesting passage at the end in chapter 7 that we read this morning, starting at verse 15, where Jesus talks about the relationship between a tree and its fruits. And he appears to say that you can know what's inside by looking at what's outside. You remember he says, every good tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. Now, it rather looks as though that wasn't happening for him in relation to the Pharisees. Many people saw only the outside. But Jesus clearly has an unerring eye which sees, which discerns the gap between the outside and the inside, and recognizes the attempts to hide what's inside. And that appears to be what drives his criticism of the Pharisees. And it also drives, of course, the Pharisees' hostility towards him, because nobody likes to be, as it were, unmasked. Now, the real question, though, is why is so much emphasis placed upon the Pharisees in the Gospels? Why are they emphasized so? And it seems to me that the point is that they represent the danger for all religious people, and especially for movements which set themselves up to correct what they see as wrong in the religious culture of their day. If you focus on what's neglected, what's wrong in your judgment, and you end up being equally unbalanced in a different way. But more widely than that, am I alone in knowing this sense of the danger of hypocrisy? When you stand here like I am now and speak, or when you preside, when you perform any of these roles that we have in the ecclesia, there's always that danger that you will be end up playing to the gallery as well, that you will be concerned for what people think of you, what impression you make, whether you can develop a reputation as a good speaker, at least in a brother's case. What impression will people form of me, and how will that affect me? Am I alone with that? I can't believe I am alone with that sensation. What's the antidote? Well, Jesus, in the first part of chapter 6, when he's talking about them as Pharisees, talks about God who sees in secret. He's implying that the only audience for our actions ought to be God. When he's talking about praying in particular, he says that you should go into your chamber and shut the door. Shut the world, the other people out. You're not performing before them for their applause, their approval. He talks also, in when he's talking about alms, he talks about your right hand and not knowing what your left hand is doing, or is it the other way around? But I ask myself, is that really possible? Can I switch off self-consciousness to that extent? And worse than the problem of playing to the gallery is playing to oneself as the audience and being conscious of what you're doing and thinking to yourself with at least part of your mind, I'm doing the right thing, I'm doing a good thing, God will approve of this. Perhaps that's only me again, I don't know, but it seems to me it's one of the classic dangers of being a Christian. That terrible sense, I'm doing God's will, and mentally giving yourself brownie points for doing it. Now, there's that terrible statement that Jesus makes about this kind of thing. He says, they have their reward. And it sounds as if he means that's their only reward. So what can you do about it? Well, what Jesus clearly implies, particularly in the latter part of chapter 6, is about the reality of God. When he talks about trusting in God, he's talking about living in God's sight, with him being the one great reality that dwarfs all our other realities, that dwarfs our own self-knowledge and what we might think about ourselves and what others might think about us. Do you remember that verse back in the Old Testament about Hagar? She says, thou, God, seest me. That's the AV version. But that sense, God sees me, is the antidote to our tendency to be self-conscious about ourselves and about our performance. His reality dwarfs everything. And our self-examination that we talk about so glibly sometimes becomes his examination of us, that we see ourselves as he sees us. And I suspect that's what Jesus came into the world to do, to reveal us to ourselves. And he has this, if you read his teaching, He has this penetrating gaze that enables him to see what goes on in human hearts and minds. He can diagnose us. We read a lot about Jesus healing people who were possessed by spirits or demons or whatever. We tend to view those passages mainly as a kind of problem that we have to explain away in first principles terms. But I'm beginning to think that what they really are pictures, symbols of Jesus healing sick human minds, twisted up by self-regard, self-deceit sometimes, and pride. And here is Jesus putting it right by showing us ourselves as we really are. That can mean cutting through all our vanity and our pride. It can also mean the opposite, healing us of our inferiority complexes. But you remember how when he heals the Gadarene man, it says, in Luke, that the man was then sitting there clothed and in his right mind. It's the effect of the encounter with Jesus. It cuts through all the froth of our self-consciousness and reveals us as we are. Now, I should say that that penetrating gaze of Jesus doesn't only refer to hypocrites and Pharisees. It refers no less to the gospel, to the sinners whom Jesus met. Now, in the case of the tax collectors, or the prostitutes, or all the other wicked people who there were around in Israel, there was plenty of bad fruit to be seen, and you could readily draw from them the conclusion that the tree was rotten. Jesus doesn't seem to do that. There's no hasty diagnosis. And I'm sure Jesus must have been very much more aware than most of his contemporaries of the force of circumstances that drives many people into bad lives. Jesus is not deceived by their bad actions any more than he is by our good actions. You think of the woman in Luke 7. Remember Chris Gaston talked about him a few weeks ago. Or the Samaritan woman in John 4, or the adulteress in John 8. Notorious people in a variety of ways, whose actions all too readily could be written off as being the outcome of bad hearts, trees that are rotten. But Jesus doesn't do that. He recognizes in the one exceptional action, the act of contrition, he recognizes in that action the contrition at the heart of those people. He recognizes the broken spirits. In that parable I referred to in Luke 18 before, you remember that what the tax collector says is simply, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And that man, Jesus says, went home justified. Jesus has seen the truth in those people just as much as in the Pharisees. How, by the way, do you think Jesus was able to do this? It's easy to sort of say, well, he had the Holy Spirit, so he just knew. I don't read it that way, I must say. Jesus was not, I think, as someone has put it, a divine mind in a human body. He was a proper man. And that, I suspect, must have meant that he knew about divided hearts as well. He knew about self-deception, about the worrying of what other people think, and the problem of self-consciousness. He was a proper man, knew all those things. If he was different, I suspect it was because of that utter sense of the reality of God. the truth that God exists, the God on whom he relied, the God with whom he lived. When he spent those nights in prayer, what do you think he was doing? I suspect he was working through with God his inner life, the thoughts that he had, the feelings that he had, gaining the profoundest kind of self-knowledge. No longer just self-knowledge, but a self-knowledge that was illuminated by the presence and the gaze of God, revealing him to himself and enabling him to perform that function for other people. Now, we don't have Jesus talking to us, looking at us, apparently. What we have supremely is his death and his resurrection. That's what we remember here this morning through the bread and the wine. And they have just this same function, it seems to me. They reveal us to ourselves. You think about the crucifixion. What does that say to you? Doesn't it say to you, I did that? I am recognizable to myself somewhere in all this gallery of human figures who together were responsible for the death of Jesus. Was I cowardly Pilate? Was I one of the mob? Was I Peter who just ran away? We're all somehow implicated. That is who we are. That's our need. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it also speaks to us unforgettably of the terrible, wonderful appeal of the love of God, which cuts through all our smugness and our self-regard and our pettiness and fills our consciousness, or should, to the point that we know ourselves as God sees us. It's interesting in the Sermon on the Mount begins with the Beatitudes, and the first of the Beatitudes says, blessed are the poor in spirit. And that's the consequence of the encounter with Jesus, and supremely with our encounter with his death. It means you're emptied of all self, all concern for self. Poor in spirit. And he goes on to speak of the blessedness of those who mourn, those who hunger. This is a self-knowledge, not as man knows, but as God knows us. But mourning and poor in spirit and hungering and thirsting are not the end of the story. They're only the beginning. They're only the starting point for something better. And what the Beatitudes say is that that hunger will be filled. And that brings me to one other word in the Sermon on the Mount that puzzles me somewhat sometimes. When Jesus talks about rewards, when Jesus says, you know, they have their reward, or your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly, what does that mean? Does that mean that we go into the same kind of calculating as the Pharisees did? What do I have to do to earn God's reward? Is that what he means? I doubt it. That sounds like merely a superior form of materialism. What is the reward, really? I'd like to quote to you what David says in Psalm 16, and that's clearly intended to be a messianic psalm. And David, Jesus, says in Psalm 16 and verse 5, the Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance. What that saying is, fundamentally, what I have, my reward, is God. I have him. Other things may flow from that, will flow from it, but essentially the reward is God, and then his righteousness, and then his kingdom. What it's talking about is it a new way of being that's free from self-love, that's about being with God, contributing to his glory. It's what the Lord's Prayer is about. The reward is what we have already, but more of it, fuller, more complete, truly living with God in Christ. Remember what Paul says in Galatians, I am crucified with Christ, he says. He's encountered Jesus. And then he says, nevertheless, I live, but not I, but Christ living in me. Or as John says in his first epistle, the last chapter of 1 John, he says, whoever has the Son has life. Whoever does not have the Son of God does not have life. To have Jesus is everything. And that's what we have this morning. We have the opportunity to be poor in spirit, like that tax collector in the temple, to confess our need, our messed up, confused consciousnesses, and allow them to be put right by the spectacle of Jesus on his cross, and in the spectacle of his life and his resurrection. God brings Jesus tangibly almost into the world in Jesus, makes his love more dramatically real for us in such a way that it takes possession of our hearts and minds. And in Jesus he has shown us what it means, what it's like to live truly with God. And we look at Jesus and we realize that it's irresistibly attractive. And we think, if that's what it's like to live truly in the presence of God, don't I want to be part of it too?